Welcome to Managing Myeloma. I'm Dr. Ajay Nuka. I'm an associate professor at the Emory Winship Cancer Institute. Today, I'd like to spend the next few minutes covering the following key aspects of managing a newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patient. I'll be reviewing the predictive measures currently available for risk stratification in a newly diagnosed myeloma patient, the key clinical and patient-related factors that could influence your choice of induction regimen, the safety and efficacy of the current modern-day induction regimens in the frontline setting, as well as the role of monoclonal antibodies in the treatment of newly diagnosed myeloma patient in the frontline setting. The current concept of myeloma relies on attaining the best depth of response in the initial phases of treatment using induction, the most effective induction regimens, followed by an autologous stem cell transplant as a consolidative maneuver, followed by risk adaptive maintenance for delivering the best depth of long-term duration of response. In the transplant ineligible patients, the same concept applies, except in the place of transplant, we use a longer duration of induction regimen followed by continuous treatment. If you look at the paradigm of myeloma, half of the myeloma patient's journey revolves around these blue blocks, which is what we call the PFS1 benefit. Mathematically speaking, if you have a billion lines of therapy to treat myeloma, billion minus one options fall into the green box, which is managing relapse. And the one line of treatment that could offer the best depth of response or where we can maximize the best efficacy of these treatments falls in the blue lines of therapy. How do we prognosticate newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients? Historically, we had used tumor burden as a prognostic factor. It didn't turn out to be prognostic, so we moved away to using routinely used lab values to start risk stratifying the patients. The ISS staging system is a prognostic staging system that was developed by the Mayo Clinic based on data from 11,000 patients and stratifying the patients to fall into three groups: the low-risk group, the intermediate-risk group, or the high-risk group, and this turned out to be prognostic based on just two lab values, the albumin and the beta-2 microglobulin. We also use genetics for risk stratification. FISH is a very commonly used test using different probes to interrogate for known myeloma chromosomal abnormalities. Unfortunately, we're limited to the probes that we use to interrogate the regions, and even though it is highly sensitive test showing more than 90% of the patients, the lesions can be detected. The cytogenetics or metaphase cytogenetics is very meaningful. A highly hyperdiploid karyotype shows a highly proliferative neoplasm or a highly proliferative myeloma, and it's seen in only 20 to 30% of the patients. Unfortunately, majority of the myeloma patients have low proliferative myeloma cells, so may not be the most ideal test that would be comprehensive. So generally, we use FISH and cytogenetics both together for the risk stratification, for genetic risk stratification. More recently, there's a new staging system that was put out, the revised international staging system, which combined the ISS as well as the FISH and metaphase cytogenetics to aim at risk stratifying these patients that could benefit the best. RISS stage one are the patients who have an ISS stage one that do not have any high risk features and have a normal serum LDH. And these patients have a 5-year survival rates of close to or beyond 80%. And this is a much more robust prognostic staging system than we had any other staging systems ever before. So what have we learned in the past from the past clinical trials? Historically, we'd used lenalidomide and dexamethasone as the standard induction regimen in standard risk patients. So the SWOG-S077 trial is a very important milestone trial in the history of myeloma therapeutics. The trial randomized patients to receive lenalidomide dexamethasone versus lenalidomide dexamethasone plus bortezomib. Bortezomib only given during the first 6 months of the patient's initial treatment. And it turned out that it had a PFS benefit as well as an overall survival benefit. If you look closely, the median PFS benefit was more than 13 months and the hazard ratio is 0.71, which is a 29% reduction in the risk of progression or death. And similarly, by giving the bortezomib as a part of the three-drug regimen in the first 6 months of life, or the 6 months of treatment, has resulted in an overall survival benefit of close to a year. So by using an effective induction regimen, gaining the best depth of response in the first initial months of treatment, you're able to confer a long-term survival advantage based on the trial from the SWOG. So the question that comes, what is the depth of response that we should be aiming for? Minimal residual disease has shown to impact both the PFS as well as the overall survival. Nikhil Munshi's group did a meta-analysis of close to 14 studies looking at the impact of PFS, looking at the impact of MRD negativity on the PFS, and looked for in another 12 studies with 1,000 patients, looking at the impact of MRD negativity on the overall survival. It is not surprising to see patients who had an MRD negativity had the best progression-free survival as well as the overall survival benefit or the outcomes. When they look closely at those patients who achieved a CR, still MRD negativity turned out to be prognostic both for the PFS and overall survival. So now that we saw the MRD negativity is found to be prognostic, how depth or the sensitivity is what we should be aiming for? This is a very important study from the IFMDFCI evaluating the role of an early versus a delayed transplant. And what the study had done was to give three-drug regimen to everyone with lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone, followed by randomizing patients to receive an early transplant versus a delayed transplant. This study, to the left cartoon that you can see, MRD negativity at 10 to the power of minus 4 has already shown to have a PFS benefit. It is prognostic for a PFS benefit. On the right are seen at different levels up to 10, from 10 to the power of minus 4 to 10 to the power of minus 6. The one on the blue curve shows that these patients are the ones that remain in remission for the longest period of time if you achieve a depth of response up to 10 to the power of minus 6. In a sense, if you're not able to identify even a one myeloma cell in a million cells, that is termed MRD negativity 10 to the power of minus 6, which has been shown to be prognostic. So which brings us to the day of modern induction regimens. Which are the induction regimens that I would go with, or which are the favorable induction regimens, and what are the downsides of each of these regimens and the upsides of each of these regimens? This is a four-day trial that was presented at ASCO of 2019. The trial had randomized patients to three arms. The first arm is carfilzomib, Cytoxan, and dexamethasone, and patients, after receiving four cycles, went on to an autologous stem cell transplant, received four further cycles of carfilzomib, Cytoxan, and dexamethasone. And then there's a second randomization to receive maintenance with lenalidomide, which is a standard of care, or Kyprolis, carfilzomib, and lenalidomide. The second arm received four cycles of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, followed by an autologous stem cell transplant, followed by four further cycles of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. The third arm, the most interesting of all, did not receive any transplant. Patients received altogether 12 cycles of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. If you look at the pre-maintenance response rates, that is, before starting the second randomization, the VGPR rates are almost similar across all patients, whether they receive a transplant or not receive a transplant, if they're receiving carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone induction. The benefit seems to favor more for the RISS stage one patients if they go for an autologous stem cell transplant, where VGPR rates were seen in 92%, versus patients who received 12 cycles of Kyprolis, lenalidomide, dexamethasone having a 79% VGPR rates. RISS stage two and three did not seem to impact much with an autologous stem cell transplant. Now, the devil lies in the details. If you look more closely with the persistent one-year MRD negative rates, patients who received KRD plus a stem cell transplant, even among these high-risk patients of RISS stage two or three, they had the one-year persistent MRD negativity rates at 90%. If you look at those patients who did not receive a transplant, even with the best induction regimen, their MRD negative rates started falling down. At 1 year, persistent MRD was seen in only 78% of these patients, suggesting the importance of an autologous stem cell transplant, even in the days of modern day induction regimens. Which brings to the next trial, which is using daratumumab in the induction regimens, as you're all aware, daratumumab is a CD38 monoclonal antibody that is approved for the treatment of relapsed refractory myeloma in combination with bortezomib, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide. And it is approved in the transplant-ineligible patients in combination with lenalidomide dexamethasone, as well as in combination with bortezomib, melphalan, and prednisone, the trials which I'd be reviewing in a few minutes. Cassiopeia is a trial that was run by IFM and HOVON. Randomized patients received bortezomib, thalidomide, dexamethasone versus daratumumab in combination with bortezomib, thalidomide, and dexamethasone. And thalidomide is the most common immunomodulatory agent that's used outside the United States. So patients would receive 4 cycles of induction followed by a transplant, followed by further 2 cycles of consolidation, and there's another second randomization evaluating the role of maintenance. This is a very important study design for us because it is asking a simple question: is there any role for prolonged maintenance in the light of an effective induction regimen using a monoclonal antibody, using the transplant, and gaining those depths of responses? So the results for the part 1 study, which is the induction followed by transplant followed by consolidation with the primary endpoint of stringent complete response, were the ones that were presented recently at ASCO of 2019. The study met its primary endpoint. Stringent complete response rates were 29% versus 20%, favoring the daratumumab arm. And safety-wise, there are no major side effects that were predominantly seen with daratumumab, except the infusion reactions. Most of them are grade 1 or 2. And the infection rates, grade 3 or 4, are almost similar. Secondary primary malignancies are almost similar. More importantly, in a patient who's a transplant-eligible patient, daratumumab did not impact the eligibility to collect the stem cells, or it did not impact the receipt of a transplant. From an efficacy perspective, at a depth of MRD negativity 10 to the power of minus 5, this is shown to be delivering the best depth of responses, with 64% of the patients in the daratumumab arm achieving an MRD negativity compared to 44% in the non-daratumumab arm. Towards the right, you see the forest plot where almost every subset has gotten a benefit from receiving daratumumab, except a few subgroups like the high-risk patients did not seem to benefit as much as the standard risk patients. I'll be discussing it in a minute. So if you look at the PFS from the first randomization, the benefit is, again, towards the daratumumab group, has this ratio of 0.47, which is a 53% reduction in the risk of progression or death. And similar benefit was seen from the overall survival. The curves start to separate, but it is too early to make any strong conclusions. The curves, again, are suggesting these are all beneficial towards a daratumumab arm with a hazard ratio of 0.43. And the most commonly used induction regimen in the United States is VRD. Is there any benefit to adding daratumumab to VRD regimen to deepen those responses, similar to what we had seen from the Cassiopeia trial? The Griffin trial is the one that asked this question, which randomized patients to receive daratumumab plus bortezomib plus lenalidomide and dexamethasone versus bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, or the RVD. It's a 200-patient trial. The trial has completed accrual. The results would be anticipated any time. And what we had known so far are the safety run-in cohort results that were presented at ASH of last year in 2018, showing that if you're delivering daratumumab in combination with lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone, you're able to see stringent complete response rates in the range of 63%, which is 2/3 of the patients achieving a stringent complete response when you get a 4-drug regimen with a monoclonal antibody. So we're all eager to see the final results for the Griffin study. How about daratumumab in combination with carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone in the newly diagnosed setting? This was a study that was presented by Andrei Jakubowiak. The results showed that VGPR rates are significantly higher as the best response rates in a small patient population. These were 91% VGPR rates and stringent CR rates in half the patients. A very good combination, well tolerated, and this could be further evaluated. So coming to the transplant-ineligible patients, the trials that have led us to the approval of daratumumab in the frontline setting are the ALSO-UNI trial and the MAIA trial. ALSO-UNI trial randomized patients to receive bortezomib, melphalan, and prednisone versus bortezomib, melphalan, prednisone, and daratumumab. As you can see from this PFS curves, the curves start to separate very, very earlier on. Even within the first few months, the patients start to see a benefit with the daratumumab arm. At the 30 months, the median PFS has not been reached for the daratumumab arm, and VMT median was 19.1 months. At 30 months, 60% of the patients who are on the daratumumab arm did not progress, whereas 28% of the patients who are on the VMT arm did not progress. This study had shown that by giving daratumumab in combination with VMT in transplant-ineligible patients, 57% reduction of risk of progression of death can be achieved by adding daratumumab in the upfront setting. This study led to the approval of this combination in the United States as well as EU. Lenalidomide dexamethasone is the other combination or the backbone that we commonly use in the United States. MAIA trial asked the question of the benefit of daratumumab if you combine it with lenalidomide dexamethasone in the transplant-ineligible patients. So the trial randomized patients to receive daratumumab, lenalidomide dexamethasone versus lenalidomide dexamethasone. At the 30 months, the median PFS for the data arm has not been reached, whereas the median PFS was 31.9 months for the lenalidomide dexamethasone arm. And the overall response rates were significantly higher. And even to the point in a transplant-ineligible patients, you're seeing in a quarter of the patients achieving MRD negativity 10 to the power of minus 5. It shows the efficacy of these modern induction regimens. So now, are there any subgroups that I have doubts about the benefit of daratumumab in the upfront setting? The first two trials are the ones that were in the transplant-ineligible patients, the ALSO-UNI trial and the MAIA trial. If you look closely in the first two graphs, the benefit seems to be more for the standard risk patients. High risk patients do not receive the same kind of a benefit that the standard risk patients have received. Again, these are not pre-specified analysis. This is a subset analysis that was seen in a small subset of patients. So I would not take this as a final recommendation, but these need to be further proved in further studies using daratumumab in the upfront setting that daratumumab should not be used in the high-risk setting. If you look in the Cassiopeia trial, which is using daratumumab induction regimen in the transplant-eligible patients, what you see towards the right is daratumumab to be better. Again, it showed the same thing, same results as the previous transplant-ineligible patients, that standard risk patients got the better benefit in terms of achieving better stringent complete responses. Based on the currently available literature, we have changed our algorithm for patients to the following. So for the patients who are transplant eligible, the most common induction regimen of choice for a high-risk patient that we'd recommend is Kyprolis, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, followed by early transplant for the FORTE trial. And for a standard risk patients, for the GRIFFIN trial, RVD plus daratumumab with an option to go for earlier delayed transplant. In the transplant-ineligible patients, for the high-risk patients, we still stick on to RVD light as the choice of induction regimen. But for the standard risk patient, lenalidomide dexamethasone plus daratumumab for the MAIA trial, or VMT plus daratumumab for the ALSO-UNI trial, or RVD plus daratumumab for the GRIFFIN trial are still options at this point of time. To conclude, our RVD experience led us to believe patients will benefit by adding more drugs in the upfront setting to gain the best depth of response. More importantly, the fourth agent that we've always looked for should not have any overlapping toxicities, and here, clearly, daratumumab does not have any overlapping toxicities, and the monoclonal antibodies seem to be showing a very innovative and enticing approach to gain the best depth of response in terms of MRD negativity. In the high-risk patients, KRd seems to be having the best efficacy as well as safety at this point of time. So we stick to KRd and transplant in the high-risk patients. We need more data to say that daratumumab should not be administered to the high-risk patients. At this point, we're still waiting for further phase III trials. Have not discussed a lot about the cost of the monoclonal antibodies in the upfront setting, but theoretically, it seems to be justifiable at this point, so as the treatment emergent adverse events. It is time to embrace the change, at least for a majority of the patients. We are seeing significant improvement in the depths of responses, and we will be seeing more and more clinical trials that will give us more information. Thank you.